Don't pay retail for your diamond engagement ring or gift. Come to cleanorigin.com. We're experts in ecologically friendly lab-grown diamonds. Mention code RADIO10 for 10% off. That's cleanorigin.com, online or one of our retail stores.
Many of us have seen firsthand the impacts weather can have on our daily lives. And today we're going to focus on the dangers associated with heat and thunderstorms. Heat-related illnesses are often underrated, and sadly, this can lead to many trips to the emergency room or worse. Today's guest, Dr. Andrew Grunstein of the University of Georgia, has been focusing on one particular aspect of the heat, how it impacts athletes and children in hot cars. These situations can lead to dozens of deaths each year, so we're going to discuss the meteorological and even some of the psychological factors at play in these events. Finally, we'll discuss the impacts of thunderstorms on asthma, an idea which may be counterintuitive to many of you, but it's real. Andy, thank you for joining us on the Weather Geeks podcast.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Well, and I said Andy, folks. I want to properly acknowledge him as Dr. Andy Grunstein, but Andy and I are colleagues. We've known each other for almost 15, 16 years now. We're in the same department at the University of Georgia, and I'm always happy to be able to talk to one of my own colleagues, because even in our program at the University of Georgia in the Department of Geography and the Atmospheric Sciences program, some world-class research going on. Let me highlight some of Andy's background before we get started. He's a professor, a full professor in the Geography Department at the University of Georgia since 1999, and he's also affiliated as a faculty with our Atmospheric Sciences program. His PhD is from the University of Delaware, actually in climatology, and I want to talk about that later. Has a master's degree in geography from Delaware and a bachelor's degree from the University of California, Los Angeles, UCLA, as we all know it, in geography, ecosystems, and political science. So, Andy, there's a question I always ask every Weather Geeks guest, just right out of the top. How did you get interested in weather or climate?
Well, so you mentioned that as an undergraduate, one of my degrees was in geography ecosystems. And I've always been really interested in how people and the environment interact together. And that was actually kind of the core of that major. And one of my professors was focused on climatology. I actually went to the University of Delaware, and that kind of focused me into the role that weather and climate might play on people's, you know, health and just how it affects our everyday lives.
So you weren't one of these people, and we often hear this with our guests, that sort of had some experience as a kid.
No, I grew up in Los Angeles, which, you know, some, you know, meteorologists might think doesn't really have weather. Every day it's, you know, 70 and beautiful. So I didn't grow up with these types of disasters, you know, hurricanes or tornadoes. Our weather hazards were, you know, earthquakes and fires and mudslides. So I was looking at maybe more broadly at sort of like natural hazards and people's health and safety.
Yeah, no, I think you have a real broad background that I've grown to know. You've been at UGA, the University of Georgia, for 21 years in the Department of Geography. Over the years, and I mean, we're going to focus a lot on your work. You've kind of over the last, I'd say, decade or more, been a key scientist in weather, climate, and health. We're going to focus on the podcast. But over the years at the University of Georgia, tell us about the geography department, the atmospheric sciences program, and for what you've been up to before you really sort of got into sort of the health aspects of your research.
Yeah, so it's really interesting. And I tell a lot of my students that sometimes you just have to be, you look around and pivot and change your interests. Sometimes my dissertation was on snow in the upper Midwest, and, you know, which definitely had a human component where, you know, water resources affected people. But, you know, as I got into my career at UGA, I pivoted a little bit because I've always been really interested in, you know, people and how weather and climate affects people. And one of our colleagues in the department who's retired, Vern Mietemeyer, came to me and brought this story about, and maybe we'll talk about this a little bit later, about a child that died in a hot. And from that point, and I remember that sort of that point where my career kind of changed trajectories a little bit. I started looking at what the conditions were like in the car, and then from that expanding into looking at, you know, more policy type things. In fact, a lot of the work that I do is tied to my role as a teacher too, that it came out of a lot of the courses that I taught and the interesting questions that students would raise.
Yeah, we're talking with Dr. Andy Grunstein from the University of Georgia. We're going to be talking a lot about weather and the human condition. And, you know, this is something that I think catches a lot of people off guard. If you look at some of the weather, National Weather Service statistics on how people die from weather every year in the United States, I think people would be surprised to find that heat is number one on that list. And you've been doing research, you know, on various ways that heat impacts the human body. I want to start with the work that you've done on heat in cars, because I think we hear these stories every year, and we're in this time of year right now, summertime, where people leave their kids in their cars or their pets or even their cell phones. But I want to focus on kids for a moment, because that tends to be the most common. And they, unfortunately, we have cases where life is lost. So tell us a little bit about some of the landmark work that you've done. And by the way, before we do that, I know you support me in this, but I want to give a shout out to Jan Null, who is also a colleague of both of ours, who has done a lot of work in this area as well. But tell us what you found over the years in your research.
Yeah. So I was going to mention Jan as well. Jan's been collecting this data set of all of the children that have died in hot cars. And, you know, we've already had 5 children this year die. On average, about 39 children a year die in hot cars. In recent years, it's actually been even worse. The last 2 years, it's been over 50. So the idea is people, you know, will leave their kids in hot cars, and there's different reasons for that. But a car works like a greenhouse. And when the sunlight comes in, it heats up the interior, and it can heat the car up 40, 50 degrees within an hour, and especially on an already hot day, that could be deadly for a child.
Yeah, and I think we all have that experience after, you know, stepping into our cars after perhaps shopping at the mall or in the grocery store, and you get back in these really hot cars, and then you imagine. Because I don't think people realize how hot it actually gets in these cars and over a relatively short period of time. Can you just give people some numbers just so that they know why they're such a danger?
Oh, sure. I parked in front of the geography department at the University of Georgia when I was testing how hot cars can get. And I put a temperature sensor in there, and it got up to about 170 degrees.
Wow.
Which is crazy. And I think, you know, most people who live in hot areas, you know, you get in your car after leaving it in the sun and you realize how hot it's in there. And you could imagine if a child's in there for some length of time. And, you know, these cars can heat up really rapidly. A lot, you know, almost 2/3 of the heating occurs, you know, within 20, 30 minutes. So one of the modeling studies I've done, actually with one of my colleagues at University of Georgia, we were looking at what temperature, you know, would kind of the human body get so hot it just couldn't cool itself off anymore. And it was about 120 degrees. So you can see when it gets up to about 170, it's overwhelming, and you can see why it's so deadly.
And if I recall, didn't you or you in concert with some colleagues develop some type of scale to help people understand how much warming is taking place?
Yeah, so we collected data in my car, and we came up with a table that would give you at least a sense how hot it would get over different time increments to show people how quickly cars can heat up and how dangerous it can be.
Yeah, no, it's a real issue. And by the way, even though we're talking with Dr. Grunstein about kids who die in cars, again, same rationale for pets and even your cell phones. You know, those things can heat up really rapidly as well. I know you work with Dr. Castle Williams on his master's thesis work, and that was an interesting sort of spinoff, I guess, of some of the work that you've done. Can you talk about what you and Castle, that research and what it was up to related to cars and children?
Oh, sure. One of the difficult things about trying to prevent these deaths in cars is that there's a couple different ways these things happen. Over half the cases are when people simply forget their kids in the car. And then the other cases are when a child might go outside and they're playing and they get themselves locked in the car. And then also there can be people that intentionally leave their kids in the car. So there's a couple different scenarios. And what Castle was looking at was what he interviewed a bunch of people and wanted to see kind of what their thoughts about this. And what he found is that people find this really terrifying and a terrible thing, but most people don't think it could happen to them. And I think that's really important for the public health messaging, because the perception is that it's these bad parents that intentionally try to leave their kids in the car. There's a case in Georgia where a father intentionally left his child in the car who died. So there's this perception that it's bad people that do this. And in reality, if you look at the cases, you know, especially the data set that Jan has compiled, a lot of the people simply forget they're not bad people. They just, you know, terrible accident and their child dies. And these people come from all walks of life, all different types of occupations. You know, it could be fathers and mothers and grandparents and childcare workers. So I think that's the tricky thing, is people have it stuck in their head that it's this bad person, but it can happen to anyone. In fact, there's a psychologist that has been looking at this called forgotten baby syndrome, where people simply forget. And the idea here is that, you know, sometimes, I don't know if you've, you know, driven home from work and you needed to stop the store and pick something up, but you went in autopilot and went straight home. That's kind of what happens. A lot of times it might be that, like, let's say the one parent normally drives their child to daycare and they switch up the routine. So the other parent goes in autopilot with the child in the backseat who might be sleeping, goes straight to work, goes into work, and the child's left in a hot car all day. That's the idea of the forgotten baby syndrome. They literally forgot. And these cases are really tragic, and trying to figure out how do you prevent these things from happening is one of the things I'm really interested in.
Don't pay retail for your diamond engagement ring or gift. Come to cleanorigin.com. Founded by a leading family in the diamond industry for more than a century, we're experts in lab-grown diamonds because that's all we do. Clean Origin, the only diamond jewelers who give you a 100-day, no-questions-asked return on your purchase. Head to cleanorigin.com or one of our retail stores and mention code RADIO10 for an additional 10% off your purchase. That's cleanorigin.com, code RADIO10.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
And we are back on the Weather Geeks podcast, and I'm talking today with my University of Georgia colleague, Dr. Andy Grunstein. I'm Dr. Marshall Shepard from UGA, and we're talking about Andy's work. It spans various sort of areas within the sort of broader topic of climate, weather, and health, and we've been talking about children being left in hot cars, and I want to sort of put a bow on that discussion and move on to another topic. But before we do, to your knowledge, Andy, are there things being done by automakers or others to help with alerting, given what you just talked about with the forgotten baby syndrome?
I know people have come up with a bunch of types of warning systems they can install in vehicles, but this hasn't been put into widespread practice. So right now, no, there's not. And so there's a lot of techniques that, you know, the public health community recommends. For instance, you know, leaving a purse or a briefcase or a cell phone in the back seat so you remember to turn back and look for your kid. And there's a bunch of different slogans about, you know, looking before you leave the car, but no widespread technology that's being used yet.
Yeah, hopefully, you know, through public outreach like this and others, we can just continue to elevate the awareness of this. And as you noted, though, I mean, we've all been in situations where we just get an autopilot in our minds and we forget things. And so hopefully we can just continue to raise awareness. I want to now shift to some of Dr. Grunstein's work on health, heat, and athletes and athletic performance and death. Andy works very closely with an organization called the Corey Stringer Institute. And if you aren't familiar with the Corey Stringer, perhaps Andy can give us a little 101 on who he is, because he was an NFL player who lost his life. And I believe there was a heat related circumstances surrounding that. And just as an FYI, Andy was recently in NFL headquarters, I believe in New York, for his career research in this topic. So Andy's certainly considered one of the leaders in this field. So Andy, can you just kind of tell the Weather Geeks listeners a little bit about who Corey Stringer is and why you got into this line of research?
Oh yeah, sure. So Corey Stringer was a Minnesota Viking football player that died from what we call exertional heat stroke. So it's heat stroke when you're participating in some, you know, high intensity activity, like, you know, a sport. You know, when he died, his wife, Kelsey, provided funding to form an organization named after Corey called the Corey Stringer Institute. And the group is focused, and they work with state high school associations and a variety of other groups trying to improve heat safety policies. Doug Casa is the one who's directing the program, is just doing a really amazing job guiding, you know, all sorts of organizations towards better safety standards.
Yeah, and so you've been doing research along with colleagues, I believe, at UGA and abroad. On this topic, are there certain types of seasons or meteorological conditions that, and I know I'm particularly interested with this because I have a son, a 13-year-old son that plays football, and they are starting next week training, and what it's really probably the warmest time of the year here in Georgia. So tell us about the meteorological sort of warning signs and times of year that you are concerned about.
Yes, so you're talking, your son plays football. Football probably has the highest incidence of heat problems and heat deaths of any other sport. And part of it's the time of year it starts. You're right. It starts typically in the summer, which is the hottest and at least in the southeastern U.S., the most humid time of the year. So already you have, you know, difficult environmental conditions. But with football players, there's a couple other things that make it really problematic. You know, they wear equipment, you know, the helmets, the pads. That stuff makes it harder for them to sweat and to cool off. One of the studies we did actually with a group of my graduate students and my colleague at UGA, Dr. John Knox, we were looking at the circumstances of football player deaths. And we found it wasn't just all football players. The ones who died were mainly linemen, like the biggest players on the field. A couple other kind of danger things that we start seeing from the study is, not only is it football, but it's early in the season when the players aren't adjusted or what we call acclimatized to the heat. That's a really high risk period. So those linemen early in the season on, you know, really hot, humid days, it's extremely dangerous.
Yeah. And I keep an eye on this quite a bit. We're talking to Dr. Andy Grunstein because, you know, I'm that parent that already is worried about my son playing football just because football is a very dangerous sport. But then, you know, you have these people and, you know, I'm sure you hear this as someone who does this research. Oh, it's football. They'll be fine. I mean, they've been playing outside for a while, but I think people, as you noted earlier, underestimate or undervalue just how deadly heat is. I mean, you see people running out in the middle of the day in 95 degree heat and very high heat indices, if you will, and so forth, and just kind of take it for granted. But yet they'll go inside if it starts lightning. And so this has been a messaging issue I've kind of harped on for years, is we take evasive actions for lightning or tornadoes, but then we do things in heat we probably just shouldn't do. Speaking of that, can you talk to the listeners about the difference between, I think people are familiar with the heat index versus something that I think you prefer in your research, the wet bulb globe temperature. So first talk about what the heat index is and why you feel wet bulb globe temperature is a better indicator in these kinds of circumstances.
Oh, sure. So one of the key things to keep, you know, people outdoors safe is kind of looking at how hot it is outside. And so we come up with these indices that combine the different kinds of things that can cause heat stress in people. The National Weather Service uses something called the heat index, and that's what most people are familiar with. The heat index accounts for temperature and humidity. So as it gets more humid, it feels more uncomfortable because it short circuits your cooling mechanism, you're sweating. So a day that's hot and humid can feel more oppressive. Now, I don't like this for athletes because it makes assumptions that aren't always mentioned. And it's really designed for just sort of your, you know, average person on the street. It's not really designed for people who are workers or athletes or people in the military. because it assumes that you're in the shade, so it takes the sun away. It also assumes you're not wearing protective equipment or gear, and it also assumes you're not very active. And activity is really important. You know, you probably know when, you know, if you were just taking a walk on a day, it'll feel very different than if you go running and your body is generating a lot of heat. So that exertion part's really important. So the measure that is used a lot in sports, in the military, in, you know, occupational safety is called the wet bulb globe temperature. And what this tries to account for is the different things that can affect heat stress. So it's actually a weighted average of three different temperature measurements. Air temperature gets hotter, it feels more uncomfortable. It has, and that's called the dry bulb. It has something that measures kind of how effective your body's evaporative cooling, your sweating will work. It's called the wet bulb temperature. And then it has something that accounts for the sunlight shining on you, and that's called the globe temperature. So it weights those three things to come up with a new index value. And it's an environmental index, so it doesn't make assumptions about your activity or your clothing. Usually what they'll do is they'll take that index and then combine it with a scale that will adjust it based on high activity. This is the wet bulb globe temperature that you should be working at, and this is the number of breaks. And when it gets even hotter, maybe you need to, if you're a football player, take off your pads and get more rest breaks. So that's how it's typically done.
Yeah, no, I think it's something that, you know, hopefully can get into the lexicon a bit more, because people like you that look at this, you know, all of the time have clearly convinced me on why we need to be using the wet bulb globe temperature. I want to sort of leverage your expertise as a climatologist. And as you heard me mention earlier, Andy got his PhD at the University of Delaware in their climatology. He has a PhD in climatology. Before I ask my question, Andy, is that, to your knowledge, the only, or I think it might be the first or only program that has a PhD in climatology?
Yeah, actually, to my knowledge, I think it is the, or at least when I was there, it was the only program in the country with a PhD in climatology. It's actually a geography program, but for historical reasons, one of the pioneers in our field in climatology, Dr. Russ Mather, I think kind of developed that specialty in climatology.
Yeah, no, I wanted people to know that, because, you know, when we have these sort of discussions about meteorology and climate and climatology and climate change, their expertise in climatology and meteorology are certainly linked and related, but there are some different aspects of both sciences. And I think it's important for people to know that, because you're a meteorologist doesn't necessarily mean you're an expert climatologist and vice versa. So I wanted to make that known. Now, the National Climate Assessment and IPCC and others have talked about the increase in sort of heat and sort of working conditions outside. We both live here in the southern U.S. where it can be fairly warm. And I think most of the climate projections suggest that we're going to see an increasing number of sort of uncomfortable days from OSHA working standpoints. So from your perspective, the type of work that you do has real implications of climate changes, right?
Oh, absolutely. We've already looked at, we know there's just more frequent hot days, there's more heat waves. We did a study a few years ago where we looked at the wet bulb globe temperature and what it would look like in the middle of the 21st century and the end. And we're getting a lot more days that are sufficiently hot, for instance, that people shouldn't be out there practicing during the hottest time of the day. What was interesting is that even states that are typically have pretty mild summers, you know, up north, you know, North Dakota, are going to get a lot more days in, you know, by the middle of the century and the end of the century that are oppressive and dangerous. And I guess I'm going a segue here, but we're actually looking at I'm working with some colleagues at the Corey Stringer Institute looking at vulnerability of state high school programs, combining their kind of heat policies and the current environmental conditions. And we're kind of keeping in the back of our mind with climate change, there's a lot of states that up north that are very unprepared as we start seeing more and more of these hot days.
And speaking of preparation and policy, kind of circle back to our discussion about heat and athletics. From your lens as an expert in this, who holds ultimate responsibility for making the right decisions about go, no go on practices, whether kids should be exposed on certain heat days. I know, for example, that the athletic association that governs high schools here in our state, they use guidelines in part informed by research from you and your colleagues. But who's, is it ultimately the parents' responsibility, the GHSAs of the world and other similar organizations, the coaches, the trainers? How does that process of decision-making work, or how should it work in your view?
Yeah, no, I mean, that's a great question. I think the first thing is it starts at the top, that the organization needs to set up policies and guidelines. Just as an example, Georgia led the nation in the number of football deaths several years ago. And in response to that, you conducted a study, and based on the evidence, they came up with a new policy in 2012. And since that policy was put in place, there's not been a single death while that policy has been in effect. So policies are really important for providing guidance, you know, and the guidance in terms of, you know, giving players time to adjust to heat. How do you adjust practices when it gets really hot outside? What do you do if there's an emergency and someone has heat stroke? Those kinds of decisions are critical at the collegiate and the professional levels. I think the next step is to really get these into, you know, for youth athletes, because a lot of times you're dealing with a mom or a dad who's coaching a team and they don't have a background in, you know, athletic training or physiology. So I think in those cases, it's really important to have the organization provide them guidelines and guidance in what they need to do. So if on a given day, it's a certain, you know, temperature, or if they're using wet bulb globe temperature, if it's certain value, then that gives them guidance in whether they should stop the practice or adjust when they're practicing or how intense they should be practicing. So I think a lot of this is they need that good policy to provide guidance for people.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's Byte.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait until you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the no animals were harmed message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
And we are back on the Weather Geeks podcast. I'm Dr. Marshall Shepard from the University of Georgia, and I have the pleasure of speaking with my colleague from the University of Georgia, Dr. Andy Grunstein, about health-related issues, particularly heat and climate and weather. But I want to pivot now to something that, when you hear it, it's going to be very counterintuitive to you. I mean, thunderstorm asthma. This is something that I think Dr. Grunstein has been pioneering in this country, at least. There's been quite a bit of work in, I think, parts of Europe and in Australia on this concept that asthma sufferers actually may have higher incidence of hospitalization rates. There was even a very high-profile case of many deaths in Australia in recent years from thunderstorm-related asthma. So, Andy, I know that I know that we have heard of this in the scientific field, but this may be something that's new to many of the Weather Geeks listeners. And I've had the pleasure of being involved with you in some of this research. So give everyone a 101 on what the heck thunderstorm asthma is.
Sure. It's really fascinating. And just to give a little background, I stumbled upon it while I was teaching a graduate seminar on applied climatology. And I found this article that talked about how thunderstorms could lead to asthma. And it, at the time, it seemed very counterintuitive to me because I always thought that when it rained, it would wash out the pollens and it should actually improve things for people. But as I've been doing this study, I've been finding that, you know, thunderstorms can lead to increases in asthma. And the one of the kind of the primary ways that people are thinking about this, and it works mostly with grass pollen, but also with fungal spores. The idea here is that the thunderstorm will draw up grass pollen into the cloud. And in the high humidity cloud, the grass pollens will rupture, releasing very small particles. And then the downdraft from the thunderstorm will spread these particles around. And people that have pollen allergies, especially say the grass pollen, will inhale these very small particles. Because they're small, they can get deep into your lungs and cause an allergic reaction. And the interesting thing is that when you start looking at who gets medical attention, the people that have really serious asthma, they're not the ones going to the hospital because they already know what to do. They have their medication for that. It's the people that rarely have asthma or mild asthma that just are caught very unsurprised. And I can't imagine how frightening it's got to be to all of a sudden suffer an asthma attack. Probably the worst case that we've seen was in Australia in 2016, where, you know, 8 people died and thousands of people flooded the emergency rooms. They overwhelmed their, they call it the 000 system, their 911 system in Australia. People were put on hold. Could you imagine calling 911 being put on hold? So these things have the potential to cause these widespread health outcomes. We haven't seen that in the United States, though we have. We did a study in Atlanta that showed that there is a relationship in the U.S. too.
Yeah, I think it's a fascinating. That's why I've played a small role just learning from you and others about this. Yeah, one of the things that I think the Weather Geeks producers wanted me to ask you in the notes that they provided is, can these be predicted, these outbreaks? And I'm smiling as I ask this because I know this is kind of where you're moving the research to, and even in some things that we've been recently doing.
Yeah. No, it's a great question. Thunderstorm asthma is really complicated because it's fascinating because it combines like different components. So you've got the pollen component, you've got the weather component with the thunderstorms, and then you've got the people component. And all these pieces have to fit together for a thunderstorm asthma epidemic to occur. So we're actually looking at that right now, trying to piece together what would make something an epidemic. You know, how do all these pieces come together? In the past, they've tried to come up with models, and there's too many false alarms. And, you know, in Georgia, we get 50 or so thunderstorm days a year. So, you know, you constantly get these warnings. People may not be listening as much. In Australia, they've developed one after that 2016 event. They developed one that incorporates, if it's a high pollen day, they're looking at thunderstorms with strong gusts, and they're currently studying to see how effective it is, sort of look at the false alarm ratio. So that's work they're currently studying, but they've implemented it in the state of Victoria right now. So our ultimate goal, though, is to really add that people component in there. My idea, or our idea that, you know, we're working on, is that we probably need, you know, widespread thunderstorms, so multi-cell thunderstorms, high pollen day, and we need people to be exposed outside. So if this occurred at 2 a.m, people aren't really out. But if it occurs during a peak time of the day where people are out and about, our idea is that that's going to greatly increase the exposure and make the thunderstorm asthma a lot worse. So that's the interesting thing. It's not just the weather part of things. You got to look at the people thing too.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's a really interesting sort of direction that you're taking this research. We were talking about climate change earlier, and with the climate change warming effects or longer growing in pollen seasons, do you see any implications for thunderstorm asthma as we shift the climate?
Yeah, absolutely. I think you're going to have longer growing seasons, so you might have a longer period of time with pollen. I've seen some studies where there's maybe increasing strength of thunderstorms that could potentially lead to stronger downdraft winds that might create more conducive conditions. So I could see this continuing to be a problem in the future.
Yeah, we're talking with Dr. Andy Grunstein, and we're fortunately running out of time here. And Dr. Grunstein's, again, a professor at the University of Georgia in the Department of Geography and the Atmospheric Sciences program as well. He's also the graduate coordinator of our program at the University of Georgia. So, Andy, last question. What advice would you give to someone that's applying for a graduate program, generally or in a geography or atmospheric or climate-focused program? Any sort of nuggets from your experience as a student and as a professor?
Yeah, I think the big thing, and this is what I tell my students or, other people that are looking at programs, that I think the key is to find the right program. And that means doing your homework. Talk to people in the program. See if your interests are a good fit. See if you feel comfortable with, grad programs, you work with a major advisor. See if that person is someone you connect well with. See if the location is somewhere you'd be happy with. So I think a lot of it's doing homework, and it's not always like the top program. I know we always look at the top programs, which is important, but I think finding the right program is the most important thing.
Oh, I agree with that. And advice I'm certainly giving my daughter right now as she's exploring colleges as a junior in high school. And that's where we have to end it. But before we do, it's time for the Geek of the Week. We like to highlight a scientist superstar, a great geologist, or a weather weenie at the end of every podcast. This episode's Geek of the Week is Kaylee Newberry. She's a young skywarn spotter from Tennessee. What makes her a geek, we ask, and the answer is this: her desire to learn how and why the weather does what it does on a daily basis. I always had that question too, Kaylee. So if you or someone you know is a deserving candidate for the Geek of the Week, be sure to follow our social media pages. Andy, thank you so much for joining us on the Weather Geeks podcast.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's been great. I'm Dr. Marshall Shepard from the University of Georgia, and you got a double dog adventure today from two University of Georgia professors. Hey, keep listening, and we'll see you next time on Weather Geeks.